I call Senate Resources to order. Today is Monday, February 2nd, 2015. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stedman, Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. I believe Senator Stoltz will be along very shortly. Thank you to Ann, our recording secretary, and Thatcher, who's running our audio for us, and my staff, Ike. So today we're going to hear from the Department of Environmental Conservation with their annual departmental overview. Senate Joint Resolution 10 was on the calendar today. That'll be postponed until Wednesday, and Senate Joint Resolution 11 will be postponed until further notice. So we welcome Commissioner Larry Hartig to the table. He brought with him four staffers, and I assume you'll probably invite those folks up as you need them, Commissioner. While you're getting settled, Commissioner, one of the things that we try to emphasize is acronyms, if you could elaborate what they mean, in other words, the words for the viewing audience. Also, I noticed there's 46 slides, and all of these legislators are experienced, decades of experience sitting at the table, so you can probably go pretty high level on a majority of it, though I'm particularly interested in slides 6 through 28, which is the Spill Response Fund. So I'll let you proceed, and please introduce yourself for the record and to your staff also when they speak.
Chair Giesel, members of the Senate Resource Committee, I'm Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and with me up here at the table is Kristen Ryan. She's our Director of Spill Prevention and Response. We have Alice Edwards, who's our Director of Air Quality, Michelle Hale, who's our Director of Water. They'll also be presenting, and I believe Elaine Bussey Floyd, our Director of Environmental Health, is also on the line. Also with me is Tom Cherian. He's our Director of Administrative Services. He's here to answer questions if we need him.
Okay.
And I will try to keep this at a pretty high level and move quick, just do some introductory slides, because what I do is want to do is turn it over to the directors to get into the details. And we are emphasizing the response fund and some of our work around that and some of our expectations in terms of going forward working with the legislator. The Department of Environmental Conservation, our mission is to protect human health and the environment. We make that linkage between human health and the environment. The outcomes that we're looking at are clean water, healthy air, good management of hazardous materials and waste. We oversee and regulate public drinking water systems to make sure that when you turn the tap on, you're getting clean, safe water to drink. We also oversee sanitary waste disposal, wastewater disposal. We also make sure that the food in Alaska that people eat is healthy and uncontaminated. We try to lower the risk of spills of oil and other hazardous material around the state. And when it does happen, we look for efficient, effective responses. We also support wise resource development in the state. We are the people that help the economic development in communities get that social license, if you will, to go forward with development, because people in Alaska can feel safe with our permits, our authorizations, contingency plans, oversight, inspections, and so forth, that it'll be done safely in terms of the environment. We have five divisions. I've already mentioned those. This just gives you a relative idea of their relative size. They're somewhat equally divided, although you'll see that air quality is one of the smaller ones, but it's probably one of the more complex ones that we have, and we'll go into that in a little bit. Next slide just shows some variety of the funding sources, since it just seems like every question these days turns into a budget question. I find that within the department. That we have a wide source of funding in the department. The circle, the pie chart on the left side there shows this, that there's about 30% that's federal money. And then we have the response fund, which we're going to talk about in more detail, which is the yellow piece of the pie. But you can see that's about 20%, you know, of our operating budget. And then the purple and red there, those are different fee programs. The purple is just colored differently because those are fees that we receive that are subject to federal law that limit those funds being used for other things. So if those would be like air permit fees that have to then be used for air permits under federal law. And then you see the UGF is only about 25%. So that shows that, you know, we're a relatively small department in terms of the draw on the UGF, in fact, general fund, unrestricted general fund. In fact, I think the only department that's smaller in terms of its draw on the general fund is Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, which is largely federal funded because of the National Guard program. So we usually run right around 1% of the general fund. Give you an idea. But what I'd really like to focus on is just those bar graphs to the right there. These are the five different divisions. And just to explain this a little bit, if you look at air quality, you see that purple bar, the other, is relatively large compared to the other bars. And what that is those are permitting fees, but again, that because of federal law, can only be spent on air permitting activities. You know, we are required to charge those fees under federal law, and we're required to use those to support the air permitting program. And you see that the UGF draw in the air quality is relatively small. So that means that the UGF is particularly critical to them if we're going to do any kind of monitoring, like, say, in Fairbanks, where we're looking at the air quality problems up there, and we need to work on air quality plans and do monitoring to see how they're working. We have very limited funds to do air quality monitoring because we can't access these other funds for that purpose. And just to the right of that, of course, is SPAR that we're going to talk to just shortly about, and you can see how critical the response fund portion is to their budget. It's about, well, you can see it's over 50% there. And right now, just to kind of give you a preview of it, if we don't fix the response fund, we'd have to take a 46% cut in that division just because of the loss of response fund money due to declining oil production. And we'll get into that momentarily.
Excuse me, Commissioner, before you go on, I want to welcome Senator Stoltz to the committee, and I believe Senator Wielichowski has a question.
Thank you. Chair. In the last couple of years, the legislature has passed laws to assume primacy over certain areas, and do you have a rough figure on how much that's costing us out of the general fund?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, there's two bills that have passed the legislature authorizing DEC to explore take primacy. There was the 404 program. The funding was stripped last year. That was $1.4 million that was removed in five positions. Those are gone now. That work, we've pretty much wrapped up. We're doing a summary of what we discovered, and that's not proceeding. The other primacy we took was 402, which is the wastewater discharge permitting program from EPA, and that was taken in phases and complete, and we have that full program now. And I'll have to get you the exact figure. I have a figure in my head, but I don't want to get you the exact one on what portion of that is paid for by the state.
Great. Follow-up question, Senator Wielichowski? No. Great. Thank you.
So if I may, Chair Giese, I'll turn it over to Kristen Ryan to talk about SPAR and the response fund.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan, and I'm the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response in the Department of Environmental Conservation. The division is comprised of three areas primarily. One is prevention, which is where we do our contingency work so people are prepared to respond if an event occurs. And then we have our response unit, which responds when they do occur. And then we have our contaminated sites program, which deals with the long-term legacy contamination that isn't addressed immediately. And then, of course, we have a small administrative unit that primarily focuses on cost recovery. Our challenges and opportunities, as we'll get into it, of course, sustainable funding has been a topic of discussion for several years. It is still the main concern of our group. And to continue to provide the same level of service when we have increasing demands and resources aren't increasing. Our mission is very similar to the department's mission. All the pictures in the slides that I'll show today are events that have happened in the last fiscal year. Some of those were pretty high profile. In fact, the truck rollover, those bottom two pictures of that just happened 2 weeks ago in Seward. Thankfully, there was no release of product from that spill, so response was immediate and effective. So moving on, just to give you a sense, we respond to all releases of oil or hazardous substances. So that means a lot of the responses we do are to unregulated facilities that we don't necessarily regulate. And this just gives you some examples of those types of facilities, any kind of air transportation releases, vessels, residents, a lot of home heating oil tanks, vehicles. None of those are regulated by us in any kind of prevention aspect.
Question. Senator Michiki?
It would have been nice to see that table over a wider span of years. Would you say that this is fairly average? Or, I mean, these are all mostly small spills across the whole state. But would you say that's pretty average, FY 13 and 14?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, I would say this is pretty consistent, and I can provide that this perspective stretched out over the years. This is a figure we collect on a regular basis. We respond to about 2,000 spills a year. That doesn't mean we physically go out to 2,000 spills, but that's how many we get calls on. And the percentage is about pretty consistent with regulated versus unregulated.
Great. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ryan, on the term, it's oil spilled. I'm trying to get my handle around this. Is that actual, what the public would think of as crude oil or diesel? Does that include the whole wide array of different process waters? And is oil used as a generic, if it has any trace of any kind of petroleum? Can you give us a little handle of that? And we see the large number reading your. I might be skipping to another pamphlet of the 355,000 gallons. I think there's intended or otherwise the public infers that's crude oil or gas, and give us kind of a breakdown of if that's not the case.
Senator, through the chair, I do have some slides on page 20 and 21 that give the breakdowns of the spills in the last year by industry and product type.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just trying to get to the basic. Well, it's the question. I can wait for 20 slides, but I think it's the premise of how we're looking at this, Madam Chair. I think the public will look at that, and I think the automatic inference is we're talking oil and diesel and other. Can you, just while we're on this point, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, just it might help our discussion of the whole process, if you don't mind.
Would you be able to skip ahead?
Of course.
To slide 21, please.
You bet.
Thank you.
So to start answering the question while I get there, we do use oil sort of as the broad category, but there are many, many products that would fit within that category. But when we do break it out, the majority of our responses are to refined fuels like diesel or heating oil. That's the majority of our, if you look at numbers of responses, but when you look at volume, produced water by a volume basis is the largest.
And Madam Chair, I just jumped. I jumped to that inference of somebody who has been watching these types of proceedings. When I see a third of a million gallons, the automatic inference I think the public makes is that's crude oil and that some of it's ballast water, some of it's drilling muds, and just that the third of a million gallons isn't crude oil that's on our beaches. And that's I assume part of this is not just for us, but for the public watching. That's why I
yes, that. And that's why I asked the department to particularly focus on the spill response fund today. And so they're going to be going in depth. We'll be able to
you'll keep me on track if I get off the trail too much.
We've got, slides 6 through 28 cover this particular issue. So,
and it was hard to cut it down to that. And slide 21, Senator Stoltz, it gives you more information about the volumes and numbers of spills. And you can see produced water was the top by volume, but the number of spills was diesel.
Senator Wielichowski also has a question.
Thank you. And maybe this is a very basic question, but What do you, when there's a spill, let's say a truck overturns or somebody shoots a hole in the pipeline and oil's spewing out, does the state DEC actually pay for that, or do you send the bill back to the person responsible for it, or I'm just trying to figure out what you need the money for, the spill fund.
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, it's a variety depending on the situation. Some are a produced water spill sometimes does not require as much response as perhaps a crude oil spill, as you can imagine. But we expect, our laws require the spiller to have the first response. If they're regulated by us, they are immediately responding, and we're overseeing their cleanup and ensuring it's adequate and will comply with our laws. If it is inadequate, we have the authority to take it over and hire our own contractors to finish the process.
Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Senator Wetikowski.
Maybe helpful, there was this spill that Alaska Petroleum had, and maybe that would be one good example, because I asked you about it in my office. That might be one example to share, because they ran out of insurance.
Yes. So that was a very recent event where we have a lot of truck rollovers moving fuel up the Dalton Highway, and one actually not going up the Dalton Highway. This one was going from Valdez up, and they rolled over, and their insurance policy kicked in. They had an insurance policy for $1 million, but it was inadequate to cover all the costs. The spill, unfortunately, was over a creek bed, a frozen creek bed, which had us very concerned. This is a creek that feeds into the Copper River system, so we wanted to ensure that all the product, all the diesel, was cleaned up before spring thaw occurred, and that ended up being a pretty expensive event to have to dig down and get it, because it saturated the ground much further than we had anticipated. So we actually, the Environmental Protection Agency, who are our partners on inland spills, decided to take that one over, but we could have just as easily done so with our authority. And then we turn around and we ask the responsible party to repay our costs. But that doesn't always happen, and sometimes there's a lag of several years when it does happen.
Further questions, Senator Wetikowski? Senator Cogdell? Yes, please.
It's one of those things where, I was raised in a family where we did fuel oil transfer, and an event like this could literally put a business out of business, you know. So having the ability for the state to pick it up and then they're going to bill them, then it's a matter of how do they finance it from there. So I think the state is the backdrop, or the EPA at this point, and that was the two things that I think I feared most from the time I was able to drive a vehicle till now is fire and spills. And those are the two biggest dangers. And this one, I think, is going to damage them probably irreparably, would be my guess. Because if $1 million can't clean up a spill, it's just amazing to me how far or how not far $1 million goes nowadays.
Good. Thank you for that input. Any further questions, committee members? All right, seeing none.
Okay, so going back to slide number 9. We've been going through a lot of this, so I won't spend much more time here, but that picture was an interesting event down in the Seward Harbor this year. You guys all know the scenario about the decline in production has caused our shortfall, and that we need about 1 million barrels a day to be coming through the pipeline to sustain our costs. And we're down to about 500,000, so it's only generating about half. And settlements and penalties come in, but they're unpredictable. They do go back into the prevention account. They don't go into the general fund. So just so you know that they do get reutilized by us, but they aren't occurring as frequently as we need them to. So some of the things we've been doing to try to reduce our use of the fund, we recognize we have a role in this to solve this problem as well. So we've been doing several things. We've had very limited growth over the last couple years. We've eliminated some large draws on the account. The account was traditionally used to fund the cleanup of state-owned contaminated sites, and to the tune of approximately $17 million over the years was withdrawn through capital appropriations to work on state-owned sites. That stopped. Those are large things that we've done. We've been trying to do all this without reducing the services we provide. And looking for alternatives to be more efficient, to do a better job with cost recovery. We've increased, we've automated our cost recovery efforts, so we spend less money collecting the money we get. We're combining two programs now. We're combining our prevention program and our response program. Our prevention program told industries in general what to do in case a spill occurred, and then our response group would come in and tell them what to do when a spill was occurring. So sometimes there would be a disconnect. So we see that there's an opportunity for some synergy there to make sure that the planners are also responders and the responders are also planners, so that they are providing the same message before, during, and after an event. And I think that will serve us as well as the industry we regulate better. And through those reductions in our budget this year, we were able to save $520,000 and eliminate 4 positions. So that's all things we're doing to reduce our expenses.
Pause here. Senator Stoltz, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It was actually back to the sustainability and declining oil production.
Mm-hmm.
Just made a couple notes as I was listening. On the sustainability, just wondering if, and maybe this is in future slides, I thumbed through this earlier, the dollars spent on or activity by your department, by industry, some of them are regulated, some are unregulated, and by sectors, I guess, what do you spend on fishing vessels and other non-oil and gas marine vessels, what do you... community bulk oil fuel tanks and oil tanks, certainly a big vulnerability on the states. It wouldn't take but one event to be pretty expensive. Aviation, which is in these a lot of segments that when you're talking sustainability and the declining production, does the department have, as you're bringing these points out, you must be hoping we're gonna take away some inferences of what you're saying. But I'd rather than us, I'd rather have direct and saying, no, we don't have these. Instead of saying we need more general fund, that doesn't seem that clear of a likely path. We all agree we need more oil production, but that doesn't happen soon enough. And we're gonna. So, how do we pay for a lot of these industries for their participation in the? In the problem, and have we even identified to a specific degree what the costs are? And I assume those will be coming forth as recommendations.
I'm going to pass this to the boss.
Yes, thank you, Senator Stoltz, who's the chair.
You could identify yourself just for the record, folks. Listening.
Larry Harte, Commissioner of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And I think you've focused right on the big questions there. And going back to slide 11, if we may, these are some key considerations that we put out there when we've been talking with industry recently on this question of, who pays and how much and how we allocate within and among the different industry sectors. And I don't want to put words in other people's mouth, but this is my sense of things, is that no one's looking at increasing risk here. We don't want to take on more risk. It kind of gets back to that social license. If we look at NPRA and Outer Continental Shelf Development and Point Thompson and Cook Inlet and more activity there and on, it's nobody's saying, well, we want to have we're willing to take on more risk with those activities. Anything they're saying, we're about where we need to be. So with that, then, I think everybody's recognizing that there is a decline in production that then makes the sustainability of the response fund more in doubt. And that I want to jump down to the bottom one about continuing efficiencies that Kristen highlighted. But then the center, that third and fourth bullet point are the key ones that Senator Stoltz brought up. And that is how about those that aren't paying into the fund right now? And aren't they part of the solution here? Because aren't they some of the ones that are causing the spills? So we have had several discussions with the oil and gas industry and have a meeting with IOGA. In fact, I talked with them just before I came over again today. We're putting together some facts and figures for them, and we'll be meeting with their board and setting up a committee to work on this. With us. The other thing that we're doing is we're having discussions with others in state government and outside government on what other people get from SPAR and whether they should be contributing. And when you look at it, there's the three programs that Kristen mentioned. When we talk about the rollovers of trucks and that stuff, we're only talking about contaminated sites. We're not talking about the prevention side, which is the most important. I mean, that's where you you really save money is by preventing spills. So that's kind of the critical piece. That's what the public really wants to see, is preventing spills. So you have that industry preparedness, and who pays for that? Well, the bulk of what they do is really oil and gas industry. I mean, that what it is contingency plans on how we're going to produce oil, how we're going to store oil, how we're going to move it down pipelines, et cetera, and put it on tankers and send it out of the state to the refineries and do that without spilling any. And those are very complicated plans that take years to develop. They usually go through all sorts of public review and comment and often litigation. And then they're there for 5 years, and they get renewed, and that starts over. In the meantime, we do best available technology conference on leak detection from pipelines and other things that get incorporated into these. It's mainly about oil and gas. And so maybe the oil and gas pays more of the industry preparedness and response program bill. And then, as we said, we had the emergency responders, the PERT, Preparedness and Response Program. There, you know, the sheer number, about 2,000 reported spills a year, probably I'm guessing 10% really have some real response from DEC, and probably 10% of that really makes the newspapers. So it's like, well, there's a percentage of those, and you have to look at how much of that's oil industry. But even there, you have to then look at cost recovery, because PERT program also does cost recovery, and so you have to kind of get down to, well, you know, who ultimately didn't pay for that. And so we're pulling those figures together so that we can have, again, that fair discussion with them and other industries. And then the same with contaminated site program. So we're kind of breaking it down by what service we provide, who uses that service the most, who's paying for it, who do we get cost recovery from so they really shouldn't have to pay twice, and then what's left. And in terms of what's left, you know, who pays for the rest of it, we certainly recognize the pressure on the general fund. That's no secret to anybody. But it's also no secret to anybody. Right now, with the declining oil production, we're going to have a $7 million hole in SPAR on a $15 million budget. That's 46% of SPAR's operating budget. That's the amount of deficit caused by the declining oil production. And so how do we fill that? If it's not response fund, then somebody else has to pay for it. And if oil and gas says it's not fair to have us pay the whole thing, then it's a couple other ideas that have been discussed in the past in the building, and there's actually been bills introduced along these lines. One is to look at the motor fuel tax, although there's concerns about that because it goes right down to the consumer. It'd be the individual consumer that's paying for that. That tax has been around a long time, and it hasn't been increased in a long time. So, and oil prices, gas prices have generally gone down right now, so some people think that's maybe where we should look, because that would pick up everything other than basically home heating oil tanks. You'd pick up everything else. You'd have aviation fuel, you'd have motor, you'd have vessels, and you would have gasoline. There's people, again, that resist that because it goes right down to the consumer. Another suggestion that I've heard from another legislator is, well, let's look at the first point of distribution, like from the refinery or from where the refined fuel first comes into the state, and assess it, the surcharge or tax at the first point of distribution. And there might be, he was guessing, maybe six of those that you would target, six different entities. So we're going to study that. We're not going to come. I'm not drafting a bill at this point to suggest to anybody, but we are into those discussions. And we sort of had that same, I've said the same thing to the finance committees and sub-chairs, and so there's a lot of interest in it. And this is the first session in nine, this is my ninth session. This is the first time there's been a dialogue. Usually it gets cut off or it doesn't last very long. I have a sense this time that people really do want to see it through and see what we can do to make it sustainable.
Good. Senator Sidman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Can you give us a brief history of when we increased this previously?
Senator Sidman, through the chair, was the legislation I believe was adopted in 1989. It wasn't too long after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and the Oil Prevention Act, Federal Act of 1990, passed around the same time, and it hasn't ever been changed. So in that time, is Kristen showed on the slide, of the last 10 years, SPAR's budget's gone up about 1.7% less than CPI in Anchorage. And in the meantime, barrel of oil's gone from, I don't know what it was back in 1989, but at one point it was down about $10 a barrel, then it went up to $140. Now it's back down 50 and lower. So it's gone all over the place, but the surcharge never changed. The only thing that did change, you may recall, about 3 or 4 years ago, it was a 3 cent, 2 cent allocation between the prevention and response account, and that was changed to 4 cent, 1 cent, to put more money into the prevention account rather than the response account.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
And just for clarification on counting the marine spills, you had several, you know, pictures of vessels up here sunk. If they sink, like, with 5,000 gallons of fuel on board, do you guesstimate the net spillage after they raise this boat, or do you count the whole 5,000, even though maybe 4,000 of it gets, you know, pumped off later?
I'll turn it over to Kristen if she wants to answer that, too. But generally what we hope is that they plug all the vents before it goes under, you know, on the fishing vessel. And it's kind of a case-by-case basis to make that estimate. There's different ways of doing it.
For the record, Kristen Ryan, Department of Environmental Conservation, SPAR Director. We count gallons spilled as to mean gallons spilled. If any fuel is recovered, then it doesn't count as a spill.
I just also want to pause here for just a second and let the committee members know that you guys send out a report on the spill response, and this is this year's report from 13-14, and it lists the various folks that have had spills and how much it cost. I mean, there's the Salvation Army is in here, gas stations, lodges, so you can actually see schools, how much it cost. An interesting point, and this, I believe, was emailed to us as your routine report. Senator Machicki, you had a question?
I do, Madam Chair, through the chair here. Just so the slide 20 shows all products, volume released by product, and four of the categories are sort of oil and gas related, I assume. Processed water, drilling muds, crude, and produced water, which adds up to 48%. So here's my question. With, you know, you talk about sustainability, I think we all agree there are far more effective pipe inspection, leak detection, HSC, and response programs in the industry the last 10 years, say. One could argue 20 or 25. But so here's my question. Is the risk footprint reduced from the decline in production? And if so, is there a potential that less money is needed, or has the industry supported the other spills to the point where that correlation just doesn't exist? You're going to need historic levels of funding going forward, even though the industry performs better than it has in the past.
Well, Representative through the chair, spills are still occurring. We have seen a decline from our prevention work. I think that has worked. So we wouldn't ever want to reduce prevention. I think you would see an uptick in spills. But because of changes in infrastructure, for example, the spills are different now. We do have the system in place with the double hull tankers, double escorts and Prince William Sound. So, you know, we're a lot less likely today to have an Exxon Valdez incident. In fact, it would be almost impossible considering all those safety measures in place. But what we are having is increased, that risk has been picked up now in aging infrastructure issues, with all our pipelines bursting now seems to be our main source of spills. So I guess I would suggest that maybe the risks are changing. As we've gotten smarter, there's other things have come online where we hadn't been paying attention to before, now have to address.
So just to follow up.
Follow up, Senator Machicki. So, but before you do that, welcome to Senator Huggins, who has joined us.
So again, that's what you were saying, is the spill, the number of spills has been pretty consistent. The gallons per year spilled are pretty consistent as well. It's just different types of spills.
Senator through the chair, yes. Our numbers of spills, if you looked at numbers, they pretty consistently end up being about 2,000 a year. Our regulated companies, when they do a spill, they tend to be bigger, but they also are more equipped to respond. Right? So it tends to be more investment heavy for us, for the smaller spills, as homes, the small villages that don't have any resources to address it. So the fuel usage in the state really drives the majority of our responses.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. First of all, on the page 11, slide 11, do not increase the risk. I hope you don't mean you're against any new developments in Alaska, because it seems like with any new development, we're going to increase the risk. So I hope that doesn't mean you're taking a stance as a agency that we shouldn't build anything more in Alaska. So I just wanted to say it out loud, because I see that and I'm thinking everything we do is going to involve some risk. But anyway, that's my editorial comment. And if you guys think that that's the case, you need to say so now. And then the other thing is, we're going to have to partner in a big way with probably the EPA and the Coast Guard, because now the Bering Sea has become one of the big risk issues that we have to deal with. And so, and this response fund is inadequate in almost every way, but is there any way that we can partner and maybe get something that helps us from this fund to move forward in that issue?
Answer.
Well, first let me start, Senator, by saying no. We believe that a robust prevention and response effort is necessary so that the risks can be mitigated, that people are comfortable with the risks that are occurring. That's I think the point we're trying to make with that slide. So it's not that we want to see less development. We want to see it done safely, and so that people are comfortable and feel that the environment's protected. As for the risks in the Bering Strait, yes, we work a lot on the trying to address those concerns. We commented on the changes to the polar code for the state. I've been attending Arctic Council meetings on prevention and response so we can form relationships with Canada and Russia, because that's going to be our partners in any sort of a response. It's a slow-moving process, but necessary. With Shell moving up there and bringing their entire response capacity with them, because we can't provide it. I think if that continues, if development continues in the OCS, we're going to see more partnerships occurring among industry as well. I mean, it's to their benefit that they share those response resources and that they all utilize the same response resources in that event. So we're doing what we can to support that. I don't know, Commissioner, if you want to add.
Yeah, I might add a couple points. Larry Hartigan, Commissioner, DEC. With Kristen and others, we've been working. I always think there's about 10 or 12 balls in the air in this area at any point in time, because when you start looking at marine transportation and you look at OCS development, outer continental shelf development, some of it's internationally regulated, some of it's national, and some of it's state. And so we have limited ability to affect things under international law. You know, like the Polar Code, that's the International Maritime Organization that promulgates those requirements under Law and Sea Convention, MARPOL. And so we can work as part of the U.S. delegation under the federal umbrella to try to affect things there, and we do. We also then work with the Coast Guard on national rulemaking on safety. And then we also work directly with the Canadian government and then also through the U.S. government on mutual aid agreements. But there's probably at any point in time at least 10 things we're working on. And what I'm planning to do as we can, we're putting together a paper that summarizes those things. I don't know if I would call it a strategy yet, but these are the things that we think from a DEC perspective need to be pursued, and maybe prioritize those and talk about now how these start linking up and how they kind of build on each other and what needs to happen first, and kind of move towards a strategy to look at how we deal with these transportation and OCS activities that are outside state jurisdiction but certainly affect us.
And Madam Chair, just a comment.
Yes, follow up, Senator Crowfield.
Thank you for that. And I realize that we're actually doing the same thing you are, and that's trying to think about all these things simultaneously. But I will say, I think for the CERVs and the Clean Seas, when they went down to the Gulf of Mexico, they hit a very high mark, I think very credible. And so I think that gave us a lot of credibility nationally and even internationally. So I thought they did very well, and maybe there's other things that, at least that was my impression, is that something that you saw, because I thought some of our crews had some pretty high marks.
Yeah. Yeah, Senator Caulfield, through the chair, and I give kudos to all our spill response organizations in the state. They're co-ops. They're private people. They're not state employees. But we work very closely with them. And when the golf event occurred, it ended up eating up about a third of my time that summer because it was deciding what things get to leave Alaska and what don't, because we didn't want to leave ourselves bare. And it wasn't fair to the companies. They had to meet their requirements under the contingency plans, the spill prevention plans. But also they had their own risk people that were looking over their shoulder, their insurers and whatnot, their boards and shareholders that didn't want to increase their own risk. So it was a bit of a process. And what was interesting to me is that the whole West Coast states lined up, and we have agreements among each other where how we share resources. So if you have a big event and you need to cascade resources in from another state or province, we can do that much easier than the federal government can because there's agreements in place. And so it was working out where Alaska would send certain things and California would send certain things, and the nearby states, provinces would back them up for what they let go from their state. But it was well planned, but I thought the people went down there, did a good job, and I thought the whole process worked fairly well.
Any follow-up, Senator Cargill? Senator Wylikowski.
Thank you. Commissioner, as some good news, we're here. Shell's going to be drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea. Does the state have any jurisdiction over how that drilling is done as far as the blowout preventers, anything of that nature, the safety of how it's done?
Senator Wylikowski, through the chair, the blowout preventers themselves would be a measure that we would look at risk reduction on blowouts, and it would be primarily regulated, though, by the federal government, and then typically Oil and Gas Conservation Commission would have state jurisdiction for what's on state land. But on Shell's operation, it is at this point all on in federal jurisdiction. So it's more we have a review capacity, and I can let Kristen elaborate on that. But the federal government's been pretty open to us commenting on their plans and giving input on all their plans, because it's also recognized that if there was a blowout or some other spill, that the plume could easily go to shore. And so then it gets within our waters, within 3 nautical miles in our shoreline. So we have to plan towards that, and so we do have to collaborate ultimately in the planning. But we don't have direct jurisdiction, I guess, but we have input. You want to elaborate, Kristen?
For the record, Kristen Ryan, SPAR Director. I would just add that we are working on a memorandum of understanding with BSEE and BOEM, the federal regulators, to kind of solidify that arrangement so that we continue in the future to have a say in the prevention and planning work that they do. But they have been very willing to share so far.
Follow up?
Sure. And are you, as a department, confident that the drilling and exploration can be done safely without risk to Alaskan waters and land?
Senator Wylikowski, through the chair, I mean, there's always going to be some element of risk. We have to be realists, is the way I'd put it, and know that when you get out into the OCS in the Arctic, you're going to have to take some extra measures, to lower that risk, because you're far from help, and weather becomes a bigger factor, and the seasons become a bigger factor. I don't know of any gaps in their planning that I can point to that I say this is some risk reduction mitigation measure that you should have that isn't there. And I think that some of the measures that they took, like the blowout preventers and the redundancies around that, can offset some of the other risk mitigation measures, like same season drilling of relief wells. And so I think there's some fair trade-offs there. So I don't feel like it's an unacceptable risk, but I do feel like we have to watch it carefully, make sure it gets done right. There's not a lot of room for slippage.
Very good. Senator Stoltz, did you have a question?
Yeah, just a couple, and you stop me if I talk to you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hartig, looking around the room, you've been to more cabinet meetings than anybody else in the room, through 3 governors. Two of the potential contaminators and have been involved in incidents, your DOT commissioner is Marine Highway System and some other transportation, and Commerce, Alaska Railroad. Have you ever had discussions about
it's all going to be state money in the end, but having the departments reflect the actual costs and gives us a better idea. So your department doesn't absorb them, but they're actually in the risk management and the causal costs of the other departments. Has that ever come up?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, yes, it has, and it's been...
You haven't won.
There's a process here, and I'll let Kristen elaborate, but years ago, I think even before my time, but it's been redone several times since I've been here, is the recognition that if you left spill response to each of the separate departments, it may not be as efficient as if it's centralized within the one department that does that for a living. And so what happens is the state sites are all prioritized in terms of which ones need to be addressed most immediately because of the human health risk, and then it's through capital appropriations then that those are addressed, and then DEC would typically have the lead and then work with the other agency in terms of access. There are a few instances, I guess, where other agencies take the lead, but I think most of them are ours.
You take the budget brunt.
Follow up, Senator Stoltz?
Oh, I'm sorry. You take the budget brunt, though, is that in the operation?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, that's the current memorandum of understanding between the departments is that we sort of oversee the cleanup of their contaminated sites, and that's the topic really here, where the most of the cost goes is their contaminated sites. It's not spills necessarily; it's old contamination at maintenance yards and things like that.
And just one last, I appreciate the tone of this. I think there's an acknowledgement that we need to do the prevention, and that's. It'd be about as foolish as a family deciding to figure out which childhood diseases that their kids aren't going to probably get and decide not to get those immunizations. We have to do this response. But I would like to help me and potentially the other members as when this fund was created in the 1989 legislature and was in the fiscal FY90 budget, how many positions this funded that were part of DEC's department, and what that is now as we're heading to FY16, and just what the growth has been on. And that will help us as we're discussing the sustainability. And that's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Good questions. I wanted to follow up on slide number 12. You talked about consolidating, if I'm not mistaken, reducing the management overhead. Could you talk about that a little bit more? You reduce the number of positions.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I know I went really fast because I was trying to fly through there. Yes, we have combined our prevention program with our response program. And in the process of doing that, we are eliminating four positions. And that saves us $520,000 in personnel costs. And we're continuing down this effort to see what other synergies can occur and how we can be more efficient. For example, our drills are sort of an expensive endeavor for us as well as industry, but very important. That's how we practice and make sure we can respond quickly when we need to. But maybe there's ways we can be more efficient. The way we're organized right now, drills are tied to their contingency plans. So a company may have multiple contingency plans and they have to drill each one. Well, maybe in a certain body of water we can do one drill and everybody that's operating in that body of water can participate in that one drill together. Because in a large response, we're going to call all assets to the table. It's not like one company isn't going to be participating just because it wasn't their product spilled. We're going to ask them to participate and help. So those are things we're thinking will save the industry money as well as make us more efficient as we go forward. So that's one example that's on the top of our list as we combine these two programs to reevaluate.
Very good. Any other questions from committee members? Commissioner, yes.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gee. So I might add a little perspective to this because I don't want to leave people with a misimpression here, is that we were starting down this road of this consolidation and efficiency work and actually talking with industry on drills and all of this and how we might do this smarter and save each other money. And then something else happened in fiscal year 15 that really kicked us into gear, and that was that we found we had a $2.1 million hole in our budget. there's three inputs into the response fund. There's the surcharge that we talked about. Then there's the interest income on that $50 million response account, that war chest. And then there's the cost recovery money that comes back in. And the legislature had appropriated us 15-point-something million dollars operating budget funded through the response fund with the understanding that there would be a certain amount realized on that account from investment. It turned out that wasn't there, and so we were $2.1 million short when we went to the bank. It wasn't in the bank for us. And so that really kicked this into gear, and so we've actually cut, so that now we only took cuts in DEC internally and moved some funds so that we're down to about an $800,000 hole. But that's in the current fiscal year before we even took the 8% reductions. So it really comes out to about a 9.5% reduction for DEC in our operating budget. But this is fiscal year 15 that all this bar that work that Kristen's talking about is occurring, but that's behind the scene. The other thing I want to point out, too, that I think is important to understand here is we talk about changes to response fund. There's a timing problem here, too, and that is that there's this $2.1 million hole, but if there's a $7 million gap starting in fiscal year 16, the fiscal year we're working with. And so if we say, well, okay, we're going to spread the pain, we're going to increase the response fund a little bit maybe, and then we're going to do something somewhere else with somebody else to contribute to the program, that'll take effect July 1, you know, 2015, then you got to collect it, so that's another year, then you got to appropriate it. So we got a hole in there, a gap. And so that's the other issue that we're dealing with, you know, with the budget.
Very good. I'll let you continue. Doesn't look like there's any other questions.
This slide 14, there's been lots of discussion about the administrative costs that are paid for out of the fund, so we thought we would provide some information to answer those questions. There's two uses of the fund for administrative costs. One is by the department overall and the administrative burden of running a department, the leases, the phones, the parking lots, supplies. The second one is what I was talking about first. That's about $2 million a year that the department uses to just cover overhead. And then $1.6 million is used by the division primarily to do cost recovery, but also to provide the databases and tracking tools that we need to provide everyone information about what we're doing. So
a question for you. So the second half of the page there, Division of Administrative Services, would this be considered indirect costs?
You could use that term, Madam Chairman. Yes, I mean there are the costs we use in an indirect pool, and it is impacted by the rate that the department overall sets for indirect that we charge the federal government and all the money that we utilize from them to pay for services. So it's spread equally across all of the fund sources. Is the point I guess I'm trying to make, and this is just our response fund's portion of those overhead costs.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, and then I will go a little quicker because I think you guys probably have heard all the rest of this before, but the new program is going to be called the Prevention, Preparedness, and Response Program. It is taking all the services and functions of the previous Prevention and Preparedness and Response Group and putting them in one. So we're still planning on serving the same people, the same, you know, there'll probably be some regulation changes in the near future to streamline our contingency plan process. I think there's some areas we can improve there, but in general, nothing should be changing dramatically on who we regulate and how we regulate them. And we, as we've already talked about, rely on local response organizations. There's five main ones in the state. Senator Coghill mentioned two that served down in the Deepwater Horizon and were highly received as having some of the best tools and processes when it comes to response. We really do have state-of-the-art response capacity in Alaska, especially in our response organizations that work with large companies. They really are top-notch. But there are reasons we continue to exist. Aging infrastructure is one that I've already mentioned. We are seeing increased problems with piping issues and spend a lot of effort trying to find those things before an accident occurs.
Can I ask a question? These pictures, how old are they? Are these like from the last year?
This slide covers pictures, Madam Chairman, from several years. These are not all within the last year on this slide. I can get you the I think one is from this last year.
All
but
right.
The big ones are not, definitely not.
Senator Wielichowski had a question as well.
Thank you. I seem to recall a couple of years ago, well, actually, probably a couple of administrations ago, we passed legislation to beef up our maybe about a pipeline coordinator. Can you tell me what the status of that is? Is that still, do you remember the legislation I'm talking about? I think it was during the Palin administration.
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, there was funding provided to DEC. I can talk to that part, but there's also a state pipeline coordinator's office in DNR that I can't talk to. I don't know how that legislation occurred. But yes, because of a large problem, a well pad, they increased our budget by, they gave us some general fund, which is on that chart that the commissioner talked about, a very small amount. There's only a couple $100,000 and paid and allowed us to hire engineers to work with companies to evaluate their corrosion integrity systems to see if they can find these problems before they occur. So that is in existence, and that's pretty recent change to our budget.
I could add a little bit to that. It's Larry Hartig again. Commissioner, that was before Kristen's time, but you might remember 2006, there were two spills that BP had from what they call flow lines, and those are the lines that go from the wellhead to the gathering center where they separate the oil from the water and the gas and sediment and everything that comes out of the well. And those flow lines aren't regulated under federal law, and they tend to be smaller and clustered, so they're harder to, you can't really pick them, and they're harder to inspect. And so that there was a worry that those would be a source of additional corrosion. So the state took over the regulation of those lines, and DEC got some increments. We put together regulations in place now where we regulate those, and we have an inspection program, and those are covered. And a large of those, most of those were also then replaced, you know, by industry to kind of deal with that issue. So I think that problem is largely taken care of, but that's, I believe, what you're referring to.
Follow-up?
Yeah. So, and I think that caught some, probably many in the public and in the legislature by surprise. Are there other ticking time bombs out there that you know of that we should be aware of? The transit lines was one. Anything else? Any other facilities? Anything that we need to be aware of?
Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, and I'll let Kristen answer this too, but I think from my perspective, I'm probably most concerned about those things you can't see. My experience has been on the with North Slope and other places in Alaska that when problems are discovered, a lot of times it's just because somebody notices it. You know, something they see it or they smell it or they step in it or something like that. And so when you get buried lines that have been there a long time that haven't been inspected or pigged, I worry. And that's when I look at OCS development, what I mainly think about are subsea pipelines and, you know, those things, if they're going to be down there a long time, how are we going to make sure that they're going to work and that we can somehow inspect them?
And this is Kristen again, SPAR director. I would add innocent passage vessels because that we don't have any mechanism to really capture them, and we're watching all the development occurring in Canada and wondering when and how that oil is going to come across our shores. So we worry quite a bit about increased tanker traffic near Alaska with limited response capacity in those areas.
Yeah, the innocent passage vessels being those that are subject to international law but not federal or state law.
Yeah. Senator Stedman, question.
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chairman. While we're just talking about this, you know, broad topic, maybe you could make a few comments on the potential work off of BC and how this would not affect us, and what kind of integration plans that you may or may not have with BC.
Yeah, Senator Stedman through the chair, and I'll let Kristen elaborate on this too. I believe what Senator is referring to is that with the oil sands production, if it they find a way, either pipeline or rail, to get it to the coast, and then it gets on tankers and it goes over to Asia. Then it's going to go on the Great Circle Route, and it's going to come north. Dixon Entrance would be the first place it gets close to Alaska, and then it would be going north and then cutting through Unimak Pass or going just south of that in the Aleutians. If it goes through Unimak, it'll come back down by Adak, but it does come close to Alaska. And that's the concern, because some of the worst accidents we've had in recent years have been drift groundings out there in the Aleutians, where a vessel loses power or steerage and ends up on a reef and sometimes breaking up. And so even if they're not covering bitumen or some other product from British Columbia, they're still carrying a lot of fuel and maybe heavy fuels and oils. So that's a big issue for us. We just completed, the state had some oversight and participation in it, but a risk assessment on marine transportation out in the Aleutians. That was some expert panels and stakeholders that looked at the history of marine casualties out there and what mitigation measures might put in place to reduce risk, and then made recommendations. Some of those recommendations we're already doing, but we're looking at that along with the Coast Guard and seeing what else we can do, again, either influencing international law or federal law or what the state can do on its own. And that's part of that list of 10, or those 10 balls in the air that I was talking about.
Kristen Ryan, SPAR Director. I would just add the incident, we had a really close call recently down near Dixon Entrance, where there was a vessel that lost control, and if the wind had blown in a different direction, it would have been on the shores, but on Canadian shores, but we would have been impacted by product. And that was, it was very difficult because Canada is, has two organizations. I mean, they have a Coast Guard like us, but that they aren't necessarily the body that is doing response. But on a local level, we work very closely with BC. And we share our resources. We flew out our emergency towing packages from Kodiak to get them to that site, and the tug was coming from Canada. So we work together really closely in our response. But it's a little bit harder to work together on the prevention side.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Just to give you a little sense of some of the prevention work that we do, just so you have some numbers here, the number of plans that we have approved in Cook Inlet versus North Slope. You'll see Cook Inlet has more right now. There's just a lot of interest in development in the Cook Inlet area. So just a sense of some of that prevention work that we're doing. And here's a slide on Shell, since we knew there'd be some interest in what's going on there. This is just, again, the statistics of what they're bringing to be able to respond to an event. And as the commissioner mentioned, I mean, it's the relief well drilling that seems to be the key prevention measure that they found in the Deepwater Horizon to be the most effective way to stop oil from being released in an event. So there's a lot of discussion about that, because it's very expensive for them to have two drill rigs in the same area at the same time. But that so far seems to be the standard that's being expected. And yes, we are hearing they're considering moving forward, and again, assuming their federal legal cases go as they would like. And we've already touched on our slides about product and spills, so I won't go into that again, but just a little bit of statistics about where spills are occurring by facility. And slide 22 gives you a sense of how those spills are occurring. Those are two leaks that happened this year. Those pictures are produced water spills up on the North Slope.
Senator Michiki had a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So why not combine human error and overfill?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I'll have to look into why we break that out separate. I think sometimes filling is something automated, but I'd have to check.
And a question. These five categories are not all occurring on the North Slope.
Correct.
These are all over the state, could be at a school or a gas station or
Correct.
A lodge, okay? Because the pictures, of course, are both North Slope, which create a sense that that's where it's happening. Thank you.
Unintentional.
Did not mean to imply that. And then again, we had, these were two big incidents we had this year, and thankfully there was no loss of life or environmental damage from those, which is pretty amazing. And then just a brief information about the contaminated site program. You know, the spills are a little more exciting and interesting, but the contaminated site program does critical work as well. As you all know, the legacy wells up on NBLM land, we are working with them to make sure they are going to meet our cleanup standards to clean up those sites, and that's a lot of work working with them to do that, as well as the other federal sites throughout the state that have spills they have to deal with. The settlement money for those sites takes a long time to come back to us, several years, sometimes more like 10 for a large site with lots of responsible parties. And a slide on Flint Hills, since that's our largest, I guess, most famous contaminated site at the moment. It's an extremely large plume, the largest in the state, impacting the groundwater of the community of North Pole. We have an approved on-site cleanup plan for the refinery now. We have gone through that process with Flint Hills so that the refinery now can be sold with some assurance as to what would be expected of a future owner to maintain the systems to keep the product from leaving the property. That was sort of the key there. There's still free product that's, you know, migrating off the property, and so Flint Hills needed to put in treatment that would stop that from happening, and they have done that, and they're operating them, so now they know the cost to do that if they sold the refinery to a potential buyer.
Kristen, Senator Welikowski had a question.
Thank you. Do you have a sense of when we can expect the plume to be controlled so it's no longer expanding, number one, and are there additional houses that are going to be subjected to this expansion, and how many houses are currently contaminated or don't have to have their water supplied?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, so the plume is moving, which is common, you know, when you have an underwater contamination. This product in particular is very attractive to water, and so it's traveling with the water. It's it doesn't care about soil so much, where some contaminants would bind with the soil and stay put. So as the groundwater moves in this area, it's moving with it. It's a difficult groundwater area to map, where it's there's sub-permeable layers, there's permafrost. We're finding the contaminant, unfortunately, not only in the shallow aquifer, but in the extremely deep aquifer, which is sort of confusing to us. We're not sure at what point it's hitting permafrost and diving, or how that connection is occurring. So it would be very expensive to map that changing dynamic throughout that whole area. So we don't have an exact sense of what it's happening and where it's going, but we do have some predictive models that, you know, it's moving in a certain direction. We're assuming it's going to continue to move in that direction. It's currently impacting over 300 homes that are on private water. Was there one more question there that I missed?
Do you have a sense of how many more homes it would?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, not off the top of my head. I mean, we have predictions about where it's going, and so I can provide you a sense of how many more we think it will affect.
Follow up, yes.
Just on when we think it might be under control, I know you and I sat on a plane next to each other a year ago or so, and you had a long discussion about sulfalane. It was very interesting. And yeah, you know, how long can we expect before this is under control? And I thought I remember you saying that when it's exposed to air, it becomes non-toxic. And is there a way you can drill down and simply bring this up so that it's exposed to air?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, what we have found on site is that, yes, these what they call air sparging, where they bring up and expose it to air and then reinject it, seems to be working in breaking the sulfalane down. The problem with that occurring off-site is just the extent of the plume and the depth of the plume. That's a lot of pumping to bring it up that far. So I don't know. We don't have a off-site cleanup plan approved for Flint Hills, and we haven't really started that yet since we've been focused on the on-site. So I really don't know yet when that plume will be stable and if mitigation will be occurring. We haven't gotten that far yet.
Senator Stoltz had a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm sure this is of interest to Senator Coggins, his backyard, his folks, but they're all of our folks. And this one, I kind of sense that, and maybe I'm asking the general, are we still evolving? I'm trying to identify the problem, and it says here there's no cleanup level for sulfaphane. If you come up with the acceptable parts per billion, is that something that a local city is going to find acceptable? And what does a family with five kids, what do they find acceptable? And what does a personal injury attorney find acceptable? Where are we? Is it accurate that this is still evolving and identifying the issue, and we're not to the solution yet? Because it seems like the solution is undefined here.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, the science is still evolving. Unfortunately, sulfaline, there isn't a lot known about it. So we're sort of the test case, and there's been some studies done. I don't want to say there's no research on it. There's been several short-term exposure studies done. The problem, though, is that chronic exposure information isn't out there. So the commissioner remanded the cleanup decision back to the division, and we are reviewing. We asked a panel of experts to look at the information available this just a couple months ago, and they reviewed it and provided us a report on their considerations based on the data that is available, and we're considering that right now at the division level to decide what our next step should be.
Madam Chair, just follow-up? One quick follow-up. Is mm-hmm. there... If we're having our in-house people setting what acceptable levels and we're not accurate, what's the exposure? Is there another higher source? We can get the feds on the hook for telling us what a safe level is. First and foremost, it's the health and welfare. I know you weren't around when the Constitution was set, but that's one of the mandates, the health and welfare, and that seems to fall within. But you also have to have an eye toward what the exposure is, and when we're setting the parameters, and what if you're wrong on what's acceptable and not. The biggest tragedy is if we have all the manifestations, everything imaginable, from birth deformities to, this is a big keg here, but with the human element, which has got to be the most important, protecting our citizens, and I think it's a constitution. But the same token, are we in an area where you feel confident that your folks can come up with the right answers that's not potentially even making it worse?
I might take a crack at this, Senator Stoltz, through the chair. That's very hard to again. As Kristen mentioned, the problem is there's a lack of studies here that we can really rely on, and there's a lack of federal numbers or other state numbers that are either they are very robust. And the main problem is that sulfaphane hasn't been as used as much, and so there's just not as much experience with it. And so the studies that are out there are short-term studies. They don't tell you what the long-term effects might be. And they're not on humans. So you're taking short-term studies on other organisms and then trying to use that to say what you think the long-term effects might be on humans. And so you have that issue. Other thing that, and there's ways of doing that with scientists. We did, as Chris mentioned, have this expert panel looked at coming up with what they call the reference dose, but that isn't the final answer. You have to take that number, which basically says that when do you start seeing problems in human populations that are exposed to sulfaphane. But then you have to look at, is it different for adults? Is it different for kids? Because kids are, by body weight, take on more water and take on more sulfaphane that way it's in the water. And so you have to look at, we have to still take even that expert information and try to make judgment calls on what truly is safe. The science never stays still. So when we work on a contaminated site and we approve a cleanup number and groundwater of the soil, it's always with a footnote that we can revisit it and maybe call back the responsible party. I mean, that's just the way it is. And but on the other hand, we don't want to take a number and say, well, we're going to leave people with that for 20 years, and if the science tells us we're wrong, well, okay, we're wrong, and we try again. You know, we try to build in some ways of mitigating that risk. And then the problem that Senator Stoltz mentioned, which is clearly something to think about, is that nobody wants to drink an industrial solvent or their kids to drink an industrial solvent at any level. And so I think from the beginning, when I first learned about Flint Hills, the situation up there, I thought they need a public drinking water system. They got to get off these wells. And that's the solution. And there were efforts to look at that, what it would cost to put in and extend some of the existing public water systems up there, and looking at the feasibility of that. And there was money appropriated last session to carry that forward, and there's some money being contributed by Flint Hills, some by Williams, some by the state, to look at what would be the feasibility and take it to that first level of feasibility of extending the drinking water system, public drinking water systems. Personally, I think that's the ultimate solution, because I think that's what the people are going to want, because I don't think we can give them 100% assurance on that this is the safe number. And even then, it's really hard to say for every member of the population that any particular number is absolutely safe. I mean, there's always going to be some risk there. So I think the public drinking water system is the ultimate way to go, but that has a cost, and the local people would have to accept that, and the fees and maintenance costs and all that. But I think that's the ultimate solution in this case myself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't envy that at all. It's kind of like the doctor, you know, like, we can't really tell what's wrong with you, but we'll know for sure after the necropsy. and that's a bad spot to be in.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Coghill.
Since it is my area, one of the things, you know, the safe levels are something that we look at, and so I appreciate the work that you guys have done and some of the independent, and I know Flint Hills has also tried to figure out some way to figure that level out and in the meanwhile get safe drinking water. So to them, you know, to their credit, they've done that. One of the things that became apparent to me, though, is that the safe drinking level is one thing, but then water that's pulled up because of digging a foundation, for example, or doing something that is like baling gravel. Have you come up with a standard that is, the way I understand it is the permitting process became pretty difficult under those circumstances. So have you re-looked at that? Is there ways that they can handle that become more benign?
That's right.
Senator, through the chair, yes, we, with the Division of Water's help, Director Hale behind me, we developed a process for people to do construction work. The water table is very high there for everybody else, so it's almost impossible to dig a hole without running into water. And here you have contaminated water, so it's sort of an awkward situation for us to allow you to collect this contaminated water and then dispose of it somewhere else. So we had to kind of come up with a mechanism that allowed that to occur, and we did so. As far as I know, we've got a permit in place for dewatering. If you're doing road construction or putting in a septic system or a foundation, there's a process you can go through that's relatively simple to do.
That was one of the first wrinkles, Madam Chair, that they came up with that I could see right off the bat. So does it involve aeration by any chance? Is it testing and aeration, or do they just have a disposal methodology?
It's a disposal methodology, as far as I remember. Right. But if I'm wrong, I will get back to you about that.
I mean, for the summertime, we could have a lot of spray going on up there, but during the wintertime, it's not going to work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I think that pretty much ties it up. I won't tie any more of your time. That was plenty. And we would move on to the Division of Air.
All right.
Time.
We have about 12 minutes left. So high-level overview.
Okay. Our air quality director,
thank you, by the
Alice
way,
Edwards,
Director
really
Ryan. Director Ryan, thank you, by the way.
For the record, I'm Alice Edwards. I'm the director for the Division of Air Quality at DEC. So I will try and keep this very high level for you. But the Division of Air Quality is a relatively small program. We focus on permitting and compliance for industrial facilities for air emissions. We also work with communities on air quality issues and do air monitoring inside the state. Some of our key challenges are in the community world, or are working with Fairbanks on the air pollution issues there. We also work on a number of rural air quality issues with villages. And then within our permitting program, we're always watching the changing federal rules. So those are some of our key challenges. The first slide I have was on the air permits program. I think you all have just a little familiarity with this. We essentially have two basic types of permits that we issue. One is for the construction of new facilities or modifications to facilities, and the other are what we call Title V permits, which are operating permits, which establish the compliance monitoring for the existing facilities and put that all into one place once the facilities are constructed. That program also does the compliance assurance inspections and follows up on permit deviations, so they monitor how the permits are being implemented by the industry. The program itself maintains an ongoing process for improving consistency, timeliness of permitting, to try and make improvements and efficiencies over time. This is a fee-based program, so we do recover most of the costs of this program through fees for different types of permits. And the permits program also responds to a lot of the general air quality complaints and concerns that we get from around the state that aren't related to industrial facilities, things like open burning or things that happen in communities. This is just a slide very quickly that talks about some of the things we've been doing related to permit streamlining and process improvement. And I guess just to keep this short, we do try to work with our regulated facilities, with our stakeholders, to try and identify ways that we can simplify things, make our permits more understandable for them, and find efficiencies. So that's something we're always working on. And I'll leave that there. As far as new federal rules and standards, we have are always seeing new standards and rules being proposed. One of the things the program does and the division does is to try and keep up with these proposals, look at them from an Alaska perspective, provide comments to EPA on proposals, work with our industry and others in the state to identify where those impacts may be and get that information put back into the federal process. Some of the standards on this slide that we've listed, one is the carbon standards for power plants, which is relatively new proposal that came out, which we commented on in December as a state, that EPA is looking to finalize next summer. Wood heater emission certification standards are also standards that have been proposed by EPA, and they're looking to finalize those here in the next month or so. And then every few years, EPA is required to update their national ambient air quality standards, so they look at the most recent science and update those. And so when those new health-based standards come down, then we have to figure out how to bring those into our permitting program, bring those into our the rest of our programs to ensure that we're maintaining protection for air quality.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
The carbon standards for power plants is falling under the 111D rule, if I remember correctly. And I would just encourage you to comment as vehemently as you can. I really, from everything that I've studied, I think they're off their authority. And I know that you have a little different position than we do, but I would hope that that you would make the strongest case you can to stand up against that rule, because I think, first of all, you know, in Fairbanks I'm going to certainly feel it, but I really, from everything I can see, I think they're off their authority. So I would hope you would see that from that perspective.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, on the authority, I know that the Attorney General's office looked at that. We would defer to them, but the main concern that we raised, as you may recall, is that the 111D rule presumes that all these existing power plants are tied to a grid where they can wield power wherever they want, whenever they want, and we don't have that in Alaska, not to that degree that the proposed rule assumes. And so that was the main comment that, as we understand it from talking with the utilities, it would, and independent study that they had done, is it would take about $1 billion to build that system to be able to move power around, so that the idea was that the rule would require you to, when there's a power demand, that you got the power from the least carbon intensive source. but you have to have a grid to do that, and you have to have backup power, and so you can bring renewables in and other things in a reliable way. And we don't have that here, so that was kind of the main thing, is that we're not ready yet for this kind of rule. And that, but on the legal authority, we defer to law on that one.
And I appreciate you making, Madam Chair, I appreciate them talking about the impracticability of it. And I think from my perspective, I will still push pretty hard on the authority issue, and so we'll see how the AG sees it.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz.
Just a quick one, and I'd probably need more follow-up later, but are we going to see more challenges on the PM attainment areas? And I've heard rumors about communities within my Senate district. Just in general, are we going to have, and I'd like to talk to you later about possible concerns on some of the other Old Glenn Highway communities in my district that be, like, so just in general about PM non-attainment areas in the state.
With Senator Stoltz, to the chair, and I'll let Alice elaborate because she would, I'm sure, has the data right in her head. yeah, we're concerned about the Butte area. And
I was trying not to mention names.
I want to mention names because I want to be honest with people that because I tried to do this with Fairbanks. I was unsuccessful, but I was telling them, Alice was 2 years in advance, you know, watch out. Don't do this.
All right.
Too late. Go ahead, Alice.
Anything else?
I guess I would just say that there are other areas of the state that have can have pollution problems from things like wood stoves in small pockets, small areas throughout the state. Obviously, Juneau has had a history with wood smoke, and so it's not confined to just the Fairbanks area, and that's something that we look at. We don't have monitors everywhere, but we are trying to be look a little broader with the communities in the state to try and help communities avoid having problems and to deal with them when they're cropping up.
But do you want to talk about the data from Butte?
And we are, through the chair, Representative Stoltz, we are seeing some data with some high values in the Butte area of the Matsu Valley, but we aren't seeing it necessarily at places like Palmer or Wasilla, so it's in a more confined area.
I mean, we're going to get their wood stoves when we fire from their cold dead. No.
Yeah.
Follow up?
That was it.
Okay.
That was editorial. I'm sorry.
Just quickly moving on, as far as Fairbanks goes, Fairbanks is the one area of the state which is currently designated by EPA as not complying with the health standards for fine particulate matter, which is PM2.5 on this slide. We did submit an initial air quality plan to EPA at the end of last year on December 31st. This has been a very controversial issue in the community. The home heating sources, especially the solid fuels, are important contributors, and we've really been focusing on trying to get cleaner burning wood heaters and into the community. We're looking at the expansion of natural gas. We think that's important to have that alternative, and then working to get more dry wood into the community, and then working with the local governments to try and find additional options to help improve the situation there.
And a comment, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Coghill.
First of all, they've been in Fairbanks many, many times and have had to face some pretty rough crowds. And just a little context of the issue. They went from PM10, I think, to 2.5 in a short order. At the same time, our fuel oil prices were going up to $145 a barrel. Everybody went out and bought these boilers that were really based on survival, and many of them $10,000 a whack were then told these are you got to get rid of them, and it created no small stir in my community. In fact, people were not very welcoming to DEC in bringing the news, and certainly not to the federal government bringing the news, because it was a survival issue. And so the education, the trying to get gas to that town were big deals. We still find resistance, but it's becoming more and more apparent when, like last week when it was 40 below, how the temperature inversion just keeps all that smoke right at under, 800 feet. And so we're just awash in it. I wish we had some of this wind in Fairbanks, but at 40 below it probably wouldn't work too good. But a compliment to the DEC on one hand for their patience. They've given us tools to work through it with. But it has been no small problem in our community, because in many ways it was people's individual ability just to survive, and it was just that dramatic. Still is, actually.
Yes. And I think this is my last slide. The point I think I wanted to make here is, given the challenges that you see in an area like Fairbanks that has gone into non-attainment area, gone into non-attainment for the health standard and the level of effort that's required to address the problem and do the planning, it's really important to work to try and avoid this in other parts of the state. And we do quite a bit of community outreach and education, trying to work with communities throughout the state on a number of issues. Typically, the issues that we see in the more rural areas of the state are dust, wood smoke, and open burning. So we're really working hard to try and get outreach and education to the communities and residents to help them understand how they can burn their wood more efficiently, have less smoke, how they can reduce their road dust impacts from their unpaved roads. And we're always looking for partnerships with the communities, with the tribes, with the federal agencies to try and bring things together to improve things in communities that are looking to improve their air quality. And with that, I think I'll stop.
Senator Machicki had a question.
I do. Thanks, through the chair. You know, I'm very focused on the lack of availability of natural gas in the Fairbanks area. So a question I have for you is that we have a non-attainment area, again, through survival, right? Does the EPA look at a community like that differently because of the lack of choice? And if so, do they have grant programs that might help us with a transmission system that gets natural gas to the interior, which I think is, from what we can tell, is the only real solution that's going to deliver some relief both on air quality and the availability of energy?
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Senator Machicki, through the chair, Larry Hartig. We've had a lot of discussions with EPA on this, and so is the borough. I know that Mayor Hopkins has been back to D.C. numerous times, and we even have had the administrator of EPA come up to Fairbanks. That was, I think, one of her first official visits when she became administrator, the current administrator of EPA. And she did come from the air quality side. She'd been up talking with Fairbanks and me numerous times before when she was air quality assistant administrator for EPA. And so I think EPA really gets that Fairbanks is a totally different situation, because elsewhere in the country where they've had wood stove problems, and there are many other areas of the country where wood stoves have become more popular as a backup energy source, you do burn bans. And that's what they do here in Juneau when the weather gets bad in the Mendenhall Valley area. Then they just have a burn ban, you just quit burning. You can't do that in Fairbanks because of the temperature. Things would freeze up pretty quick. And so it's not a solution. This really is viewed as a unique situation. But the federal law is what it is. And so if you put it in front of a federal judge, they're going to say, no, this is the law, and you got to follow it. And you got to get into compliance one way or the other, or I'll take it over. And that's what we were so anxious to get our plan in and work with the community to get a plan in, because we didn't want to be having a federal district judge dictating air quality plans for Fairbanks. That would be kind of unwieldy. So they do understand the differences in terms of federal money. They've I think made one grant that I recall. It wasn't that large to Fairbanks North Star Borough, but I don't know of any source of funds. But I know that the mayor's been pretty active in trying to pursue that over multiple years, and I'm not aware of any. But we do get discretion from them. They can only operate so far, though, because there are also other NGO groups that are very focused on the human health issue side of things. And there's been litigation to force EPA to move along and get the state to move along on this issue a little quicker. And so we have to be sensitive to that, too, that we're getting pushed from the other side, too.
Very good. You have one last division to go, and that's water, I believe.
Want to make it just a couple of minutes?
I think we'll have to, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Director Edwards.
I'm Michelle Hale. I'm the director of the Division of Water of DEC, and I will make it very short, just focus on a couple of things. I think I just pushed this to go right.
Yep.
Yeah, there we go. We have two components, the water quality component and the facilities component, and facilities is where our Village Safe Water program is. Water quality is where our permitting programs and water quality standards programs are. So I want to touch on the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program, or the APDS program. We've had full primacy for that program since 2012, but primacy began in 2008. We are doing a great job with our permits. We inherited a large backlog of permits from EPA. At the time that we took the program from EPA, they were issuing about 6 major permits per year. Last year, we issued 19 major permits and 744 authorizations. So we're shooting for about 20 this year. Steady state will be 24, and we're doing great. We have really good staff. The last couple of years, in 2013, the 404 bill was passed, directing the state to go out and see, should we assume primacy for that program. So we worked very hard on that, exploring whether we should assume primacy, as well as trying to improve some of the wetlands permitting in the state of Alaska. We lost the funding for that in 2014. Some of the things that we've done are we developed a detailed plan for assumption, should funding be restored at some point, and we've also taken all of the work products that we did generate in that year that we had funding and neatly put them away so that if this comes up again, it'll be very easy to pick up the work that we've done and move forward. We've also developed, worked on mitigation strategy for Alaska. Mitigation is a really big issue for a lot of people, and it's going to get even bigger as the Corps requires mitigation for wetlands projects. You've heard us talk over the years about the funding gap, or the decline in funding to fund village safe water, drinking water and wastewater facilities in the villages. So that funding's declined $62 million or 64% in about the last 10 years. So we've been talking a lot about the funding gap, and we have some ideas to address that gap. But I wanted to touch on a little bit of why that's important. There are still about 4,500 homes in rural Alaska that have never had primary service, primary drinking water and wastewater service. There's a direct correlation between clean water and public health, between health. There was a pretty fascinating hand-washing study in Pakistan that demonstrated the very direct correlation between just having, it was a soap hand-washing study, just having enough water and soap to wash your hands dramatically reduced illness in children. Dramatically reduced death rates. Children in southwest Alaska suffer some of the highest rates in the world of pneumonia. There's for homes that do have running water versus don't have running water to wash hands, the homes that don't have running water, there's an 85% higher rate of hospitalization in infants for pneumonia. So that's the kind of conditions we've got in rural Alaska. You may have heard us speak a little bit about the Alaska Water and Sewer Challenge, and this is that different way of looking at how to address that huge funding gap between need and available funding. So what we did last year, or a couple of years ago, is launched basically an international challenge. It's a public-private partnership, so that it's asking teams of people around the world to look at in-home water and sewer service rather than these big centralized water and sewer service. So that that project is proceeding. We've got 6 teams right now that are actually developing their plans. We'll develop prototypes for these in-home systems. These are decentralized systems. The idea is that they'll provide water and provide sewer service at much less capital cost and much less operating cost. And I think I can wrap it up.
Wow, excellent. Senator Coghill.
So we have an entrepreneur in Fairbanks that is actually looking at some water treatment that actually can take their gray and sewage water and process it and then actually turn out a fairly decent water. And so I know they're at least one, and they're entrepreneurial driven. So I hope that we're not spending state money to overrun those kind of entrepreneurs. That's all.
Quite the opposite, Senator Coghill, through the chair. Our idea is to leverage that private know-how and RD money. In fact, we've got the State Department. I'm interested in making this one of the U.S. projects during the U.S. chairmanship of the Arctic Council and running it internationally.
It's good work going on this. Madam Chair, it's just phenomenal what some of the research has been able to show up. And I think the more we do them, the less the cost is going to be. So I think I'm looking forward to these villages getting the benefit of this, because the operation of some of the, you know, the bigger systems has not gone that well, in my view.
Thank you very much, Director Hale. Sorry about that brief time period. Commissioner, thank you for the overview. Anything further you wanted to add?
No, thanks for the opportunity. If anybody has any questions and follow-up, just feel free to contact us.
Some hot topics in your department. So thank you very much. So for the committee, our next meeting is Wednesday, February 4th. We're going to be hearing from the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, otherwise known as CACFA. They're going to present, as well as Department of Natural Resources, on ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, and the Alaska Statehood Compact Act. I would forewarn committee members, we will likely go till 5:30 on Wednesday. So with that, we'll adjourn now so everyone can get back to their other business. The time is 5:10 p.m.